Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. He's backstage now, shooting a rod of semen into his own mouth. Please welcome Richard Herring! Thank you. Thank you very much. Good to be here. You're much better than last week's audience. Oh, you are. Hold on. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, or as all the cool kids are calling it, Rehearlestapur. Thank you. It's been quite a week, hasn't it, Dave? It's been all right. Dave at the front there, you'll have missed that if you're at home. He's a good lad. The honours list came out, which was very exciting, and I was delighted to see. This really moved me, actually, because we get a lot of honours and some people we don't think are worth it. But it was great to see that Prince Charles has become a Field Marshal, Admiral of the Fleet, and a Marshal of the Royal Air Force. It's incredible. Must be chuffed to bits, mustn't he, on his amazing triumvirate of success he's had. Most servicemen and women don't would be happy to get one of those, but to get all three, it's amazing. He must be over the moon. I know some cynical people might say, you know, you've got a Republican agenda, that he only got those accolades through nepotism, but that is ridiculous, frankly. His mum must have been aware that people would think that. She would have thought really hard about whether she was going to give them to, and she did it anyway, which proves that he definitely earned it for all his brilliant army, navy, and flying around stuff. Must be punching the air when he got the news. And some people, I bet still, even now, I bet some of you are cynically saying that he didn't deserve it. But I'll give you this piece of information. I think you'll realise how foolish you are. His dad, Prince Philip, also has all three of those things. So it's clearly a genetic trait. I'm amazed we've got an army at all. Why don't we just have the royal family? They're so good at being in the army and stuff, aren't they? They're like the Avengers, the new ones. They're the five of them, probably not Prince Edward, to be fair. But Andrew would be in when he's all right. Charles, Princess Anne on a horse. can have a crack. It's amazing. And the government are cutting the budget anyway, so it's, let's do it all in one go. And I just hope that Prince Charles doesn't listen to any of those naysayers who didn't think he deserved to get the highest possible position in all three branches of the military. I'd hate him to be thinking, hold on, I'm a 63-year-old man having special awards pinned onto me by my mum whilst dressed up in fancy dress. I should feel nothing but shame for going along with this pantomime. At least it wouldn't be quite as bad if I'd done anything at all to deserve it. I hope he isn't thinking that, and I hope there's people, because that would be wrong. I hope he's thinking, yay, look at me with all my medals and stuff. I'm brilliant. Ask my mum. If you don't believe me, ask my mum. She'll tell you how good I am. She won't let me be king, though. That's a shame. She's trying to distract me with all this meaningless shit. I don't know. But Armando Iannucci also got an OBE. He's next week's guest, OBE. I didn't even know he was related to the royal family, to be honest. So, it's well done to him. We'll talk to him about whether satirists should accept baubles from the Queen next week. That'll be interesting. Be interesting. I reckon I'm better than Alistair Campbell. I reckon I can give him a run for his money. So, anyway... we're going to crack straight on. We've got an amazing guest. I haven't appeared on stage with him. Oh, look, he's there. He's, that's professional. He's grabbed the curtain, ready to. He's ready to open it. And no one can see that. That is, he knows that as a professional, no one can see he's there. He usually works in TV, but he's come into the future. I'm giving him a chance with his crack on the internet, and hopefully this will work out for him. I can help him out. Will you please welcome the star of Sky B's Up Your News? It's Stuart Lee. Stuart Lee, ladies and gentlemen. Stuart Graham Lee. How you doing, Stu?
Thanks for having me.
It's all right. This is the internet this goes out on.
Oh, yeah.
Although it is being filmed, there are people at home. You'll see cameramen walking around so you can talk. Just to make you feel at home, because we know you like to work in a visual medium.
Good.
You are able to look at the camera. So you look down and say hello to the people at home there who have bought Fist of Fun Series 2. They've got it now. There's no video, so it's all right.
This is an extra for that as well. Yeah, yeah.
The first thing, what do you think about Armando Iannucci getting an OBE? Are you delighted?
I think it'll be weird for him because obviously, you know, he's supposed to be. People will go, yeah, that's all well for you to say that, but you're an OBE, won't they? And yeah. He will have to find a way of negotiating it. On the other hand, it could be hilarious to have, you know. But it's strange, that sort of generation of people, right? Charlie Brooke has gone to Sky, Armando's got an OBE. It is weird how they're sort of being assimilated by the establishment, and there doesn't seem to be anyone in their 20s that's an equivalent sort of figure coming through.
You've got a BAFTA?
Yeah, no, you're
right. Two British Comedy Awards.
Although, to be fair, I was cut out of the television broadcast for making confusing an acceptance speech that confused Kate Thornton.
It's well worth saying. I looked at it. They talked to Kate Thornton, who I don't think is used. She said something like, it must be great. There must be people out there who didn't give you jobs in the past. Are you glad about that? And then you compare it to the weather, which is kind of...
Yeah, so you know, well, you can't...
Make a philosophical
Well, I said
point.
That the commissioning procedure in television is so random that to think that it's for or against you is the same as thinking that if the sun comes out, weather has kind of favoured you, has an opinion about you, or if it rains on you, weather dislikes you in some way. So I said, I don't really feel you can ascribe any motive or moral worth to it. And as I was saying this, I thought, this isn't going to make the television. But I didn't do it. I just felt like when you sit there in the ceremony, and we've both been to lots where we've been to them, we very rarely get to pick anything up. You sit and watch, but you think, what are you talking about? You know, like it's like when people thank God as if God would have an interest in Halle Berry's role in a James Bond film. You know, like, so you have to be a bit careful of thinking that it means anything. And at the same time, you have to appear to not be ungrateful, even though you look at the... Who, I don't even know where they come from. Or
well,
how
you're
it's
up
decided.
There with Keith Lemon, got one, didn't he? So you're up there.
Yeah.
You're up there now with him, so that's the...
Well, you know,
that's how you can
that's
judge
the other
it.
Thing. It's always baffling, the whole thing, you know. Yeah, you don't want to be... But, you know, you also can't start behaving with a sense of entitlement, because, you know, as well as I, it's entirely random and comes and goes and doesn't mean anything.
You know? Yeah, but then but when you get one, then it does mean something, because then the BBC have to give you another series.
Well, luckily, they've done that. Otherwise, it would have been really awkward for everyone, I think. But it's funny winning something through the BBC. We had to go on a table afterwards for dinner, and it was me and Jennifer Saunders, who I think had won something as well. But because it's the BBC and they're under such scrutiny from the tabloid press and the right and government and whatever, they can't be seen to be splashing cash around. So we couldn't really have any champagne. And all around us there were tables of production company people, independent broadcasters, out of their minds. And the guy from BBC Comedy had to work out if he got enough cash in his own wallet to be able to get a drink, because they're not allowed to put any of your money through the system to wine and dine the stars, which is, of course, absolutely correct, but quite an odd situation to be in when all around you people from poor quality Sky television programmes... out of their mind on a cocktail of champagne and drugs paid for by the advertiser. Hey, you didn't hear that here.
It goes out into the world.
I thought a podcast, just you listen to it at home.
Mainly it's just me. Right.
ongoing vanity project.
I just like to record every single thing I do in my life.
I know.
And then I record myself listening to it.
Yeah.
Lego, that was
well,
me.
Well, you know, you say that as a joke, but that is a bit what the world is like now, isn't it? I mean, everything's so... We were talking about this backstage, actually, and because it was a conversation between us that was private backstage, I assume people like you will be interested in it. But we were just saying how odd it is that now... Everything is if you do a gig and you're trying to work out new stuff, you're kind of worried in a little club somewhere that it'll be filmed and it'll be out there and you can't kind of control it. Because everything now is filmed or recorded or put on the internet, and yet there's all sorts of stuff we did together and on our own in the 90s that you in retrospect wish somebody had been interested enough to record, because you've got no record of
but
it.
But even
now.
Like with Talking Cock, which I'm doing this year, and Christ and Mike, which I did a couple of years ago, I had no record of them at all, apart from two people had taken them illegally in the audience and put them on the internet. So I was quite glad that they did that. But I would have had no record
of it. People's memories of them were much better than the actual. Yeah.
But imagine you won a BAFTA on your own. Imagine if you'd had like a funny bloke coming in doing some actual jokes in the show. How many. Imagine how many BAFTAs you would have won. It's amazing you've done that on your own. It's like,
no, I know, but,
it's like Sid Little winning BAFTAs. just do it. And Eddie Large isn't even coming on. No, he's just staying backstage.
No, don't think I've not thought about that. I mean, when I got the British Comedy Award, I listed all the people that I felt I'd ever worked with who'd been, you know, hugely helpful, and I did mention you, but that was cut out of the television board. That was about as interesting to them as talking about the weather on the BAFTAs. Yeah.
So I want to get this over with quickly, because I want to be able to link to this podcast to all the people who tweet me and say, why isn't Stuart Lee on Twitter? So if I put this early in the podcast... Right. It's not just limited to 140 characters, Stu. I can put a link and they can listen to 90 minutes of a man talking. But then you can explain why you're not going to go on Twitter and then I don't have to reply.
Firstly, it's because Rich has just explained something about it that I didn't know before. So I didn't know that. Okay, I think when I first heard about what Twitter was, about 6 months ago, I put my name into the search engine, and I don't really mind about people slagging me off and saying they hate me and they wish I'd die of Crohn's disease and things like that. But I honestly don't. I really, really don't, honestly, even though there are people in my family that have had issues with that illness. I don't really mind that. But I do. It was a lot of stuff of people saying where I was with my children and what I had been doing with them and how I was in a pizza restaurant with my son and he did this or whatever. And I thought, God, that's really freaked me out, to be honest. I felt that was quite easy. And I know you're telling me you only find out about that if you do a search on your network.
So if I saw you in the street and then I went into a restaurant and went, Stuart Lee's out there, more people would hear about
I didn't really understand that. I found that a bit disturbing. The second thing is, I sort of think that that everyone's excited about it because you get instant feedback from an audience about what you're doing. And I sort of think you have to think that what you're doing is worth it, irrespective of what the audience actually think. And so I think you have to press on regardless and not be swayed by public opinion.
I think but that's not even... I think the main thing about it, people just pretend to be you, and so every now and then I have to just go to people, they at me and you, me and Stuart Lee One, who isn't you, in, and I have to go, that isn't actually Stuart Lee, that's some idiot pretending. Why, if you're going to pretend to be anyone, why would you choose Stuart? You can choose anyone in the world, and you go, I'm going to be Stuart Lee. But it's more about you gather information, you can get... I think what's quite interesting about it as well is if you follow a few people, you get to see the joke that everyone's making about the subject, and you realise what's the obvious joke straight away. So if even in your head for a second you thought, oh, I might do that joke, you look at Twitter and go, 50 people have done that joke.
Yeah.
The annoying thing is you tweet something now and there's so many smart asses out there trying to come in with a joke. You're trying to self-edit yourself in order for there to be no way that they can make the joke that you know they'll make if you don't.
Nothing is. I barely have time to do what I'm supposed to. You know, the other thing is that increasingly in stand-up, I feel I have to separate out who I am from what the stand-up character would do, and irrespective of what I would do, I might possibly use Twitter if I had time, which I don't. But Stuart Lee, the comedian, would despise it. He would hate it, and he would hate the idea that he had to communicate with people. So I have to not do it because he wouldn't. You know, I mean, I know that sounds really
honestly,
mad.
Honestly, a comedian with multiple personalities is just that.
But quite a lot of things in my life now are like, I think that's one of the reasons I was happy to, when the BBC were talking about doing another series. Well, they initially didn't want to, and then Sky did, and then the BBC did, and there were all sorts of discussions about whether people would you go to Sky and whatever. In the end, it never came up because what the comedian Stuart Lee would do is he would stay at the BBC where he had been consistently badly treated and marginalised and let down, and he would stay at a place where all the other talent was leaving for Sky. And he would sort of do that out of a sense of perversity, irrespectful. So I sort of thought, he would sort of stay there and, like, complain while the ship was sort of sinking. And so in the end, the decision sort of made itself. Because what I would do sort of doesn't really matter. You have to think what he would do.
Right.
You look at me like I'm mad, but he would...
He was never stayed. Like this when I worked with him. There was only one of
him. Well, that's because in a double act, you have the other person to create a dialogue with. But when you're on your own, you have to develop essentially a split personality. So I sort of thought, he would stay there because he would like the feeling of being sort of a marginalised figure when everyone else had gone somewhere else for higher rates. You know, he would kind of do that partly, and he would sort of do it out of a sort of weird sense of, like, superiority. And so I don't really know, you know, it just felt like the right thing to do for him. He has to kind of stay there. You look at me like, you know, it's true though. It's like he's slightly different. He's largely the same as me.
I play snooker against myself in my basement and I talk and commentate on it. Yeah. I can't, there's nothing. There's about five or six of me in that. So,
so it's sort of sometimes you have to make decisions based on not what you would do, but what this person that you sort of are, but would do, who isn't you. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yeah. It's amazing that anyone can make a living doing what we do. What you do, I don't make a living. But I'll ask this question so I don't forget.
But just go back to Twitter, right? How do you do it? Because there's all sorts of yous, aren't there?
Yes.
Right. So there's the sort of solo show where there's the thoughtful bits and the monologues. There's the lively, combative, comparing thing. There's columnist. There's blogger, and then there's the Twitter thing. And they're all slightly different. Yeah. How do you synthesize those into? How do you give an account of yourself on Twitter as a particular person when you occupy all these different spaces?
Just do whatever I think come over. Just write it in, and then sometimes it's too long and I change an and to an ampersand.
Right.
Good.
But you know, but I, that's what. But what I like about comedy is like being able to do loads of different things. Yeah. Where you have really kind of within comedy anyway, because yeah, we do lots of things outside of comedy. But you've really kind of stuck, which I think is probably why I'm not very successful. But because you know, I'll do a different when I do a stand-up show. You never know the next year whether the stand-up show will be the same, even the same kind of persona on stage exactly. Well, they're increasingly it gels. I mean, you've been working, I guess, on the same stand-up character for a lot longer than I have, because I didn't do stand-up for years in between, and you kind of carried on through, while we were doing the double act. You were still doing your solo stuff.
Yeah, although I only feel it started to gel about 9 years ago, really. Yeah. But yeah, well, I mean, I've partly done that because having kids, you have to make decisions about... You have such... Your time suddenly disappears. So you have to think, are things financially worthwhile or are they artistically worthwhile? And I do those things. Weirdly, tonight is neither of those. and yet I've come... Well, the same. But you know, you have to make those decisions, and you kind of can't afford. I mean, I look at the variety of stuff that you can do, and I think, I couldn't. Like Rich had lots of ideas at the weekend about, you know, maybe we should have tried to write some new material in the vein of Lee and Herring today. And it's just kind of the problem is today I had to draw a big pirate ship with stencils. And then, you know, it's sort of like you kind of... So it's just sort of difficult to do something like that. You kind of, your time disappears. So, and also, having been in a kind of... with a stand-up, I kept trying to get away from it and do other things and take things from my stand-up into those things, like bits of theatre or writing fiction or whatever, or things that were like one-man kind of performance-y, arty kind of shows. And in the end, all the things that I did in them, I realised I was better at doing stand-up, really. And I kind of had to consolidate in that. You know, I couldn't really afford to keep losing the money.
No, but I actually, I don't remember, I don't know if I said to you, but when you were doing, when you went the period where you stopped doing stand-up, which I thought was a shame, when I said you should carry on doing stand-up, I think it was very good for you.
I remember where that was.
It was very good for you to have the time off. But I also thought... You were writing these things for the Sunday Times, you know, you were doing stuff for journalism, and you were doing different... you were doing all these different things.
Yeah.
And I was just sort of saying, you know, I was just thinking, you know, if you could just go back and do stand-up. So it is...
Yeah, but you know, at that point, you know, that was about 2000, and, like, I'd gone to Edinburgh again with a new show, I remember that year, and I'd come out £8,000 in debt, and somebody had tried to organise a tour... where it was me and Andy Zaltzman supporting me, and none of the venues had been told Andy Zaltzman was coming. So I travelled around the country for about 2 weeks with Andy Zaltzman as this kind of weird chaperone figure who had no gigs but had to go to Glasgow and stuff like that. And it just kind of, by the end of it, I just thought, I can't do this anymore. You know, and so I stopped. And I, during that period, which is also the period of doing... Jerry Springer, the opera, which also, because famously didn't really turn a profit. My main source of income was I did 2 record reviews a week for a Murdoch newspaper, who's my default arts patron, and I won't have a word said against it. And the only reason I'm here today is because of his generosity. He's not aware that he commissioned me, but he's a huge fan of the gay San Francisco punk bands I wrote about. But... you know, it was just the fact that I felt I couldn't keep losing money, you know. No. And I thought there must be another way of using those skills. As it turned out, there wasn't. And then, you know, then I went back to doing stand-up.
But
and,
also,
know.
By I think A, by doing Jerry Springer, which was an amazing show, but it did mean that all those kind of it was really important in the progression of your renaissance, I think, and that it meant that you were suddenly taken really seriously by
absolutely.
All those kind of the critical kind of artsy people.
You know, your old management, I was with Avalon, you know, they rightly or wrongly, their thing is they sort of try and package all their acts together in projects to get as many people through the door as they can. And Richard Thomas, the composer stroke comedian, had... You know, Jerry Springer the Opera was well underway when John Thoday suggested that I helped out with sort of writing a story and getting it on its feet. And so by association with it, the same kind of critics that would have seen my stand-up in the 90s and said, he doesn't know what he's doing, it's rubbish, because they'd now given something else I'd worked on good reviews, they had to give it the benefit of the doubt and go, this long, boring bit where there are no laughs, presumably there's some reason for this. and it absolutely was. It was like basically being associated with an Olivier Award-winning thing meant that you got reviewed by a different kind of person. When people say to me, how did you get to do this kind of stand-up at the level you're doing it, there's loads of reasons, and they're not to do with merit. They're to do with luck, you know.
But, you know, I think things do boil down to luck. I mean, I think that there is some merit. Oh, God, did I say that? There is some merit involved in it, but it did also give you the impetus to come back, and the show you did when you came back was a result of all the Christian protests
The second one was, but I mean, partly why I came back to doing stand as well from Jason and the Opera was you could be in a thing round the corner here at the Cambridge Theatre. I mean, we were there for 2 years in a 500-seater, and the expense of running it and the legal costs of fighting a different people that tried to close it down meant that I'd have been better off doing stand-up in 30-seater pubs for 4 years, you know. I mean, it's kind of, people don't really believe that, but again, you were kind of, I was even more in debt by the end of it. I used all my savings up on being able to carry on working on the opera because the assumption was at some point it would pay off. And it wasn't entirely the fault of the producers because no one could have foreseen 65,000 people trying to close it down for no good reason. But it did mean that I thought, well, I need to make a living. What can I actually do?
Yeah,
I can do stand-up. And also, having worked with Richard Thomas, I sort of thought he'd taken music theatre and he'd done what he wanted with it, which was for it to not be shit. And I thought, maybe you could do that with stand-up in some way. So it was, you know, I thought you can. He has lots of wise epigrams, Richard Thomas. Like, you know, if you don't try and fit in, you haven't got to compete. That was one of them. I don't know what it means, but I said that a lot to myself, and it was all right. No, it was kind of, you're forced back on it because there was no. I mean, I was in my late 30s, and nothing had worked out. I thought, well, I'll try again at stand-up, and I didn't have any hopes for it really, or expectations, and that added to. But you know, I mean, you do get back to what you wanted. I mean, you must have found that you've been through so many things, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, because I didn't like stand up when I first did it, and we both did it for a couple of years when we first came to London, and I couldn't find what I wanted to do with it, and I was trying to please other people and not necessarily myself, and just got confused, and I didn't like it and decided I couldn't do stuff on my own. But the big thing for me as well was coming back to stand up, and then exactly the same thing, just going, well, I'm going to do whatever I want. And I did a year of touring around clubs when really people didn't know who I was, and doing 20-minute routines about buying yogurt in a. And it was interesting because, you know, you got different kind of reactions, and you'd driven 300 miles to do a gig or 150 miles to do a gig and had to drive straight home again that night because there wasn't enough money for a hotel. And so, you know, you learn by doing it. And so I think the autonomy of stand-up is I can see appealing to you because you like to just be in control of everything you do.
I do, yeah. I know, that's true.
Yeah.
That's an accurate criticism of me.
It's not necessarily a criticism.
Well, no, it's true. I mean, I can't cope with the surrendering of authority about things that I've done, and I think you make your bed, you know, and you lie in it, and I'd rather something just failed and it was entirely my fault than I'd had to, you know, I can't cope, and it's probably some kind of mental illness, but I, you know, can't do it. So
you know what you want?
No,
the moon and the stick. Sorry, I thought they were getting a bit. I thought I'd throw them a bone. They were getting a bit bored.
Yeah, I know.
They've paid £12.50 to be here, Stu, and they want to hear all the catchphrases.
Yeah.
I'll get them all out. I had to go on Twitter to ask
Remember
people to remind me of what we used to say.
Yeah, that's funny actually, because not to devalue anyone's nostalgic relationship with things we did 20 years ago, but sometimes I'll be walking along the street and someone drives by and shouts something at me. And what the fuck is that? Like some phrase from something. Which was only on once. I just remember Fist of Fun was never repeated anywhere.
And also, really, like, there's loads of stuff from the radio. Sometimes things will come from the radio. Should be in 1993 or 1992. And you go,
then they think you're being rude, but you can't remember. when we did the commentaries for the second series, which I understand this is going to be an extra of, there were things that I have no memory whatsoever of having written or performed or have gone to the place where they're filmed, right? It's like a strange... I think that period, we did so much and we worked so hard. I mean, it sounds really... I mean, I know there's people like... There's probably people listening to this who work in mines and stuff and they're going, well, you
there
don't
aren't.
Really.
We don't let them...
No, you don't.
Don't let them listen.
No. But actually, I can't really... I was saying backstage, which I can't remember much about 1996 to about 1998. Sort of. I know you were involved.
I was there. There was an early version of Rehypnol involved. It is weird. Well, I saw an episode of Time, Gentlemen, Please, which I wrote and you script edited the other day, or it was a couple of years ago on you know, satellite TV somewhere. I was thinking, I don't remember this one at all. I don't think I could have even have come down to the studio for this one. I must have been writing. And then I'm in the episode. I come in and go, I don't remember that bit. So, you know, you're churning out. We were writing shows, especially when we got into This Morning, I suppose. We were writing the show mainly in the week, weren't we?
Yeah.
When we did Time Shouldn't Please, I was generally writing them in a week. But
well, actually, the thing about that, This Morning, Literature Jeeves, you were sort of... You had to kind of turn up on a Sunday morning at about 5:30 to do all the... And it was like being sort of jolted awake into this kind of strange dream-like situation where you were trying to remember things that you'd written in the week, and I mean, it's like a...
It was, well, yeah, we got up at 5, then we recorded it live, well, we did it live 12:15, and then we'd be finished by 1, and then we'd work really hard all week, and then we spent... I can't believe we can remember this year, because we then went out to the back of the Riverside Hammersmith where there's a patio, and drank vodka and Red Bull for 8 hours.
Yeah.
Seriously, we just drank... We'd go across to the off-licence to buy the vodka, because it was too expensive to get it from the bar, and so we'd literally... we probably drank a bottle of vodka each a day.
Well, it's very weird, traumatising experience. Also, particularly in the second series, you had this feeling right from the start that you were working quite hard on getting it together and trying to come up with 45 minutes of new material every week, which was about the news, which no one else had ever really done before or since, for good reason, we now realise. But I also knew right from the beginning that it was going to be over.
Yeah.
We kind of knew a decision had been made at the top level, that some kind of mistake had been made, and why was this on? And you sort of knew that, because every week you'd look out into the audience and there would be the sympathetic but ultimately crushed faces of various comedy executives from the BBC who had been told that the head of BBC Two was going to come with them that week, and there was an empty seat next to them. And you just kind of could just kind of feel it slipping away. So it was a really strange thing. It was like you were drinking, you know, in the last chance saloon, as they say. But then the other liberating thing about that was, because we knew no one was interested in it, we were able to sort of do whatever we wanted, because no one was even watching it or checking what was in it. And in fact, I used to go out on Sunday mornings and then live, and then I used to go in with the producer, Charlie Hansen, to do an edit on Thursdays to cut it down to 35 minutes when it went out on Friday nights. And I remember one morning, it was a Thursday, and we were in rehearsal, and we opened the paper, and the show was listed as going out that evening because there'd been some sport on and they'd moved it, but no one had told us. And so the edit hadn't been made. The programme didn't exist because no one... They made that decision to move its transmission time without telling anyone even involved in the production. So the actual 35-minute edit, we had to kind of find somewhere really quickly and just stick it together with sellotape and glue and stuff and send it off. Now, that's an indication of the extent to which it was not cared about, that no one even chose to tell us that it was supposed to be on and it wasn't made. And
I swore in it nearly every week while we were singing the King's song. We go, there's one king, and then I'd go, wang king, or I'd go, we go, far king. Yeah. So no one spotted any of that. So there's, if that comes out on DVD, you can spot that.
And very often people come up to you, you go, oh, I remember that thing you used to do on Sunday mornings. How did you get away with it? Because no one cared about it. No one was even interested enough in it to see what was in it.
And no, but I think also the people who care about that stuff aren't watching at 12:15 on a Sunday, because they kind of presume they don't have to kind of get their beak into that, because there's not going to be some things about Jesus. Maybe they tuned in and saw, oh, it's the thing about Jesus, we can turn off, that's fine.
But I think that's sort of what you want. Certainly with the second series I did of Comedy Vehicle, I don't quite know how it got recommissioned, but it was, they moved it to like 11:15 and it was on a much lower budget, and again, I sort of felt much freer to do kind of better stuff, because I thought, no one was really interested in it. And the problem is now that's presumed to have done well. It'll be moved back towards the daylight, which means it will inevitably be worse.
People will see it, they'll realise what it is, it'll be taken off the air. Right, let's clear up some things that need to be cleared up. In 1987, I've spoken about this, we went to the Edinburgh Fringe. I've spoken on other podcasts. And there was a turbulent time, we were young men. I'd had sex once for 35 seconds with a lady. I'm not sure you had at this stage.
No question that as includes the phrase, we were young men, is going to end well, is it?
I was crying one night on the floor of Johnson Terrace because of someone had upset me. And to cheer me up, you decided it would be a good... Do you remember this? Or I imagined it? No. Where you decided it would be a good idea to attempt to wank me off with the hand of a ventriloquist dummy that had been made by my great-grandfather in 1895.
Well, I knew that. Yes. I knew that it was very important.
My great-grandfather could never have imagined, as he sculpted that hand out of papier-mâché, what it would be used for. Why did you do that?
Well, first of all, can you remember what you were upset about?
It's something about Rich Canning, I think, wasn't it? Was it about...
Okay, well, we know. Something, probably...
I wasn't upset that I hadn't yet been wanked off by a man utilising a ventriloquist dummy. That wasn't what I was like. If you thought that was what it was, no. You were sadly mistaken.
Okay, is it just me? Or look, there's a man leaving there. He's going, I didn't come here to hear a description of a man being masturbated with the papier-mâché hand of his own great-grandfather's hand-sculpted ventriloquist puppet.
You're probably the third person...
And yet
person,
it appears he did.
You're probably the third person to touch my penis.
Well, it wasn't... I didn't touch it.
What? Did Ali suddenly acquire the ability to move his hand around
I didn't touch it. It was no more me than it would be if Orville had raped you. What it is, do you know, like, when someone's really upset about something and they're crying, do you ever get this where you think, oh, I could try and say something really consoling and sensitive here, or I could do the most inappropriate thing I could possibly think of, which may, like, sort of jolt them out of... You've done that. When Pete Bainham told you his...
There was both ways around. Pete Bainham did it to me. When my granddad, who gave me that ventriloquist dummy, handed it down from his father to me, when he died, I went to... It was the other way around, then you write back in your book. We did it both ways in the end. But I came back to the flat I shared with Peter Bainham at that point. He was in the kitchen, and I came in. My granddad had died. I was very upset. We'd been to the funeral. And Peter Bain turned to me as I walked through a door and he said, I am delighted your grandfather is dead. And it made me kind of laugh and cry simultaneously.
Because it's the use of the word delighted. Yeah, it's delighted. It's so polite and formal. It's really funny.
So when his dad died, I did it back to him as well.
When his dad died?
Oh, yeah, when
that's he's... much worse than your grandfather. That's...
I think actually, when his dad died, I came in with a smirk, and he said, and Pete preempted and he said, are you delighted?
Well, I saw you were upset, and I thought, I bet he wouldn't expect me to try to masturbate him with the papier-mâché hand of his great-grandfather.
It was only for a little while. I didn't get erect or anything. I'm not turned on by that kind of thing. Not now, maybe, but not then.
No, I just think... I've never done anything like it since. I thought...
It's
it
rare
would be,
you get the opportunity, though, that there's a dummy there and a crying man. You need both those things to come together.
It would be absolutely the wrong thing to do. So I did it. Yeah. But I mean, it was, wasn't it?
It was, but you know, when I blanked out from my memory for a long time, and I think it came back to me during a podcast, and I wasn't sure whether it actually happened. I just think that kind of the Olivier Award winning director. Stuart Lee, kind of can't find. I think Laurence Olivier probably did quite a lot. I'll give you another piece of housekeeping that I have to ask everyone in this. I've asked everyone. We'll get this out of the way while we're on the subject. I've been asking all my guests this, apart from Jonathan Ross, who I forgot to ask. Have you ever attempted to suck
He's
your own cock?
He's the one person who could probably have done it.
He probably is. Yeah. From what I've three turkeys can get on there. Have you ever attempted to suck your own cock, Stuart?
No, I haven't. And no. I can barely tie my own shoelaces.
I think out there, the listeners to this podcast, I think a lot of people who haven't tried it have listened to this and then probably tried.
Yeah, well, you must and be very proud anyone. Of what you
It's opened a new... 70% of people have those two, so you're in the minority by not attempting
Well,
it.
I also don't use Twitter. So I feel it's very similar to sort of suck you
Right, in Edinburgh, this is the other thing I've mentioned in the podcast. I don't know if you remember this one, and I don't know if you are guilty or not of this one. When we shared a flat in Edinburgh in 2002, we had a conversation, and then when I woke up in the morning, we were all a bit drunk. All the cupboards in the kitchen were all smashed in, like someone had punched them.
I don't remember that.
Who did that, Stuart?
Me.
It was either you, me, and I've forgotten, Richard Thomas, who was living in the flat that year, Chris Addison, he wouldn't punch some cupboards. Maybe Dan Antipolsky.
God, I've got no memory of that at all.
Well, it might have been you.
Well, I don't remember it. What was the conversation about?
I don't know, I think we were
was
talking...
Was it how
about...
would you best smash those?
Maybe I annoyed you about something. I can't remember what it was. I'd annoyed you.
Really? I'm really sorry. I've got no memory of that whatsoever. Okay. No,
well, that I'm not saying you did it.
No, I'm not saying I did it. But
I reckon you did.
I remember that flat as being a very harmonious
one. It was just one night where, for some reason, I think what I said was... this is quite... This, but it was not
I
even
bet
about...
you couldn't smash your cupboards.
I said, have you ever attempted to suck... ventriloquist dummy's cock. I came in and I was talking about I was doing Talking Cock the first time and you were doing Jerry Springer the Opera, and I said what's interesting about this is that these have both been quite successful shows, but four or five years ago we wouldn't have even attempted to do either of these shows because of their content. Because we kind of made a pact when we first met in 1986. We hadn't seen each other. I did a song called My Penis Can Sing that you hadn't seen.
Yeah.
And you'd done a sketch about people queuing at a bus stop with fruit. Do you remember that?
No.
No one else remembers that one. Everything he's done since then isn't as good for me. That is, I liked him when he did the bus stop fruit sketch that I didn't actually see. We met at a party and we decided to write together, and then we made it very early on. We said, right, what we're going to do is we'll define ourselves by what we won't do sketches.
Yeah.
So we wouldn't do anything about TV parodies or...
It's funny that in the new stand-up show, I do a 20-minute bit where I compare the Thatcher government's economic policies in the 80s to the plot line of a Scooby-Doo cartoon film called Scooby-Doo and the Pirate Zombie Jungle Island. And I do that because the joke is that, as a father, my only frame of reference is watching Scooby-Doo with my son. Then at the end of that whole bit, about 20 minutes long, I go... ideally, it gets applause, and then I go, don't clap a Scooby-Doo Thatcher routine. In 1986, when I first started writing comedy with Richard Herring... we made a list of 10 things that we thought were too cliché to do jokes about, and two of the things on that list of 10 things were Scooby-Doo and Thatcher. We all grew up to be the person we despised as teenagers. So I remember that list.
Yeah. So because everyone was doing things about Fergie having a fat arse, or it wasn't John Majors being grey, but it was that kind of thing, was then later on. So we made that decision, but both doing it, if we'd said... Let's do an opera based on Jerry Springer. Just as the idea.
Yeah, it wasn't my idea.
And it wasn't your idea, but it's it's the way you execute. Doing a whole show about penises, it would be the
no,
most
I,
obvious.
I wouldn't have had
thing.
That idea actually, because I'd have thought that that's sort of why would you do that? And actually, what working on that made me think is that actually subject material is not the problem.
No,
it's like how you handle it, and that's what I learned from Richard Thomas. Is actually there's no such thing as bad subject material. It's only It's all about how it's written, performed, and the tone of it, which is why it's really weird when you get these writing briefs from TV executives, right, where they say, we're not interested in stuff about this, this, and this. And you think, well, it's not a point. What it's about doesn't matter.
No.
Because some of the greatest sitcoms of all time are about pretty dull things, and some of the great stand-up routines are about really, really, you know, really obvious everyday things. It's about the language and the performance.
Did I read on Chalk today that BBC Three? Did you see this? BBC are looking for. And I thought they'd done a list of the three things that you mustn't do. Right? Yeah, usually they go. Don't do a common thing about someone who's just won the lottery. Don't do a thing about two misfit brothers moving in together and having to live together. So there are these obvious things that everyone writes about, but they've listed three things that they wanted. They were quite specific.
Yeah.
Like one of them was two brothers move in together to a factory, a family business that they have
to run.
That's
not to say that those couldn't be really good sitcoms, because it doesn't really matter what the subject is.
But it's odd for them to be looking for a very specific thing. So
why would you look for a sitcom about a subject? It doesn't make any sense.
No.
Because it's never the subject that excites me. I mean, there are lots of sitcoms about vicars, but there's only one Father Ted. And that's Father Ted.
Yes. Yeah. But I think you could write a sitcom about someone who ran a hotel in Torquay.
Yeah.
And it would be a different thing. It's not like the situation, it's what you do with the characters, and if you can make enduring characters. It's like things are discounted because they're like something else. Well, or they're taken up because they're like something else.
Yeah, well, given how I agree with you about that, it seems unlikely I would have smashed these couples.
It does. But who did smash them?
I don't know.
It's a mystery.
Yeah.
Might have been Richard Thomas.
Might have been. I don't remember anything about it.
Filled with anger. Yeah. I think you were quite drunk at the time. You might have just, I'm not accusing you. I brought it up in a podcast before. Now I've got you here. I thought I'd try and get to the bottom of it.
It's not come up
before.
It's
going to have to be another 10 years of... We'll find a clue. Get Scooby-Doo and Margaret Thatcher.
That could be your next series of podcasts. Richard Herring's Cupboard Smashing Clue Hour. Each week, Richard Herring tries to find out who smashed some cupboards in 2002. Suspects are brought in and interrogated.
There was a small amount of ventriloquist dummy semen on the handles. That's why I suspected you. Which is made of shredded 1898 newspaper. Cool. My favourite thing you ever did, and I'm wondering if you're ever going to bring this back. I genuinely think the funniest thing you've ever done is Pliny from His Store and Pliny.
Yeah, I know a lot of people said that. Well,
genuinely,
I've got the puppet.
Yeah, I've got the His Store.
But my
puppet.
Voice is broken now, which it hadn't. I don't think I could do the voice. Yeah, that. Yeah, that was good.
Try and do it.
I can't even remember what he spoke like.
I don't know what it was. You've got to go and look on YouTube. We won't be able to recreate it now. Yeah. What I love about it, I watched about four or five of them, and they were really making me laugh. Because we should write a sitcom with them in it. Historically. Yeah. But we recorded those like at the end of a day, all of them, all in a row. And we were really tired anyway. And our voices are just completely changing. The accent's going. The kind of puppets. They were really heavy and we had to go underneath them. And my one was especially heavy. Mine just is like a 45-degree angle. There's one bit where I have to pick something. Hister's meant to be picking something up with his wing. And I'm not as good with puppets as you are. Manipulating them. I mean, you apparently could just pick up a puppet and make it masturbate a man's penis without touching his penis. That is an amazing skill. But like the wing of Hister is like a foot away from the... from the body of Hister, and I was trying my best to do it. Well, it wasn't like we were trying to do it badly. We were trying our best to do it well.
I hope we can get the rights to those, because actually, the interesting thing, I mean, the Fist of Fun, we had a budget for it and time, and yet I think there's lots of things in this Order to Do that were done on nothing in a minute that are quite good. But you know, it's be quite interesting to see that again. But I don't know if we'll be able to get it. But yeah, no, Fister's I was. I remember that was, that was quite a...
Well, Pliny is very stupid and just like saying egg about everything.
Yeah.
But then every sketch, there'd be one moment of kind of lucidity where he would explain the truth from a kind of left-wing perspective to St. George. And you kind of think, what's Pliny doing? Well, he's pretending to be really stupid, But he's he's really glad to enjoy saying puns about eggs and crows, about everything, even though they don't sound like it. And
my subsequent solo success to stand-up has basically been based on channeling that character. As a man,
I just think, you know, you should do broader stuff sometimes, because that it was that. Why don't you, Stuart Lee is one thing, and then just I don't think even Histor should be in it.
Yeah,
it should be Pliny on
his
own.
I'll do that. I will do that. I'll do a whole one of the next series as a crow.
But we forgot to take that this morning. Yeah. Richard Judy ended, and we forgot to take any of the puppets and. I think Pliny had died and was there. He was all covered in white, I remember, the last time I saw him, because he was a ghost. And we just left them in the studio and forgot all about them. And then about 4 years later, they were on Live and Kicking or something, just in the background of some sketch, sort of being thrown around and used in a... We forgot about them. We got them back.
Were we able to get them back under the pretense that they were characters that we'd invented, therefore they weren't allowed to be... used in...
Yeah, it's true. And it's outrageous that we... Yeah. This is a lot of people listen to this. It is a very puppet-based podcast, I realise. But, maybe we could get all the puppets together. I've got Ali and Sally in Histor, and who knows what might happen. A few vodka and Red Bulls.
Yeah. Puppetry on the podcast. Good,
when you say that, I play snooker against myself.
I know, yeah.
That's a very visual
thing.
You
said backstage, you were saying... that all these, they seem to reach a period in the podcast, your interviews, when there's a kind of lull, and then it picks up again. Yeah. Is that where we are?
Yeah,
now?
I think it's been mainly that all the way through. It's been mainly lull this time, it's quite nice. It's quite nice and chilled out. People are hanging on every word. Yeah. It's just a pity there's nothing very interesting coming out. Let's have a look. What else I wanted to talk to you about on my. On my list of stuff, because it's ridiculous this, because I know too much about. We've talked about quite a lot. Now, what I think what's quite interesting about you is that your character. I've turned into David Frost in this one. Is that your character of Stuart Lee that isn't you is based on being a kind of outsider and a bit of a failure, and now you are in actually a much higher status than the character used to have.
Sort of, although. There's been just enough in the last couple of years that, for example, after the first series of Comedy Vehicle, they didn't want to recommission it, so that was sort of left for about a year and a half. And then the second series, they didn't want to recommission it. And actually, when I started writing the stand-up tour after that, one of the sort of status-lowering threads in it was that I'd done this thing and it was perceived as doing well, but they weren't going to recommission it. Then when I got the British Comedy Awards, it was sort of the second one was cut out of the broadcast and it wasn't mentioned in the newspapers. The BAFTA award was cut out of the broadcast. It wasn't mentioned in the newspapers. But you're absolutely right. And I mean, you can't do that again. You probably come back and have to do something different. Although there, in as much as you separate yourself out from the character of the comedian you pretend to be, the Stuart Lee comedian is so sort of paranoid and suspicious that he would still feel hard done by whatever had happened to him. But you're right. It doesn't really make sense.
But it also, David Baddiel was talking about this to me last week. When you are taking the piss out of other comedians, which
me.
Is kind of when you're taking the piss out of other comedians. In your sketches and stuff, that actually within the industry and within comedy, your status is incredibly high.
Yeah, but not in the world.
But I don't know. I think.
Like my own family aren't really aware that I'm on television. Honestly, I'm not. It's not. It might be, but there's nobody I take the piss out of that isn't doing rooms five times the size.
But it's not necessarily about this, because it's also about whether you see doing big rooms as being more important. You've got the critical acclaim. So you're saying, like with Russell Howard, for example, Russell Howard will probably never get, who I think is a fantastic comedian, but he will probably never get the Guardian saying he's a fantastic comedian. So in a way, by your status rising, even though I know this isn't what you're doing it for, but does it get to a point where that could be seen as like bullying?
Well, you know what? That's interesting, because that sort of, while I was working out the material for that show, for that series, I was sort of aware that the critical perception of me was changing to the point where it would be weird to take the piss out of those people. And but it wasn't again that the particular routine you're talking about Russell Allen. I mean, I did it here every night for 3 months, so I remember it pretty well. But it was the idea was that he would do like one charity event, and everyone would go, oh, it's brilliant. And yet it would be a tiny percentage of his presumed income, as reported in newspapers, as £4 million a year. Whereas the bitter Stuart Lee comedian would do like two benefits a month forever, and that wouldn't be a news story. So kind of, in a way, I had no opinion about him. I didn't really even know what his material was at the time. So, you know, but he was, he did seem to, when I met him around that time, I was quite upset about it.
Because... I mean, he was upset about I think, I think in a way I completely see, because I think the routine's so stupid that it's a mathematical joke of you saying, because he wouldn't, if he did it every day, he wouldn't make the money. So it's not really a joke about him. But I think because those kids all grew up liking you as a stand-up, and then it's kind of weird for you. It may be, and I'm not saying I think this, but maybe it is perceived because the status of your characters changed without necessarily you...
Being aware of it.
Yeah, but also... That it turns from being the underdog kind of...
I know, you're right. But I mean, but on the other hand, I don't have enough of an audience to do the gigs of the size he does. And you couldn't... There's no way you could massage the figures of my income to be £4 million a year.
But would you want that? Want to do it, and also... That audience isn't... Your audience is pretty much guaranteed. If you can fill this room for 9 weeks, then you don't really have to worry about working ever again.
No, you're right.
And you'll be able to do that...
I'm dead, which will be soon.
Even if you were never on TV again. If you were found having sex with the child, that might...
Yeah. But not necessarily.
Not necessarily. In some ways, it might...
It would be a different audience.
He'd be very much like my audience.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you're right, and I sort of didn't. I hadn't really factored this in, you know, because you're so used to being an irrelevant figure.
Yeah.
That there's some when you're largely irrelevant, there's something sort of heroic about having a pop at people, you know, because it's like you're doing it from the bottom of the pile, and then kind of weirdly that sort of changed, and the material was like a year behind. The perception, you know. Yeah. And I was doing a benefit for New Zealand earthquake victims, and Russell Howard was on, which is weird because he doesn't do a lot of benefits. But he was there, and people were going to me, oh, Russell Howard's on, and, you know, he hadn't been out on telly at the point, this piece, but, he knows you're doing this bit about him, aren't you embarrassed? And I went, no, because... If he sees it, he'll know that it's like it's a kind of mad mathematical joke, and the joke's kind of on me as this person who feels hard done by. But then he talked to me about it backstage, and I was trying to sort of explain it, which was going all right. But then it was going all right. But then his manager had been standing like hiding behind a curtain with his back to me, so in the dark where I couldn't see him. And then I was
like
going,
it's
this. Yeah, James Taylor. Yeah. And then he turned around and he went, tell him about when you say this. It was really weird. It was like, but I know, I'm sorry, I'm sort of upsetting, but I kind of think I don't even really know what his act is. I don't really know anything about him, other than that I'd read that he'd earned £4 million a year. And then about 2 days later, I read that he'd made 35,000. Yeah.
I think the problem is he doesn't earn £4 million.
No, I know. Yeah. So, but my question is, where did that story come from?
Yeah.
You know, and the weird thing is, because I'm also a quasi journalist, I got sent a press release about 2 months ago about him doing two gig benefits in London, but 90% of the words on that press release were about how many videos he'd sold and how many people he'd played to the rest of the year. So I think it's actually a problem of. It's difficult when PR uses charity as a marketing tool, and that's sort of what that was about.
Yeah,
you know, and because as soon as you, if you have a paragraph about the charitable donation, but the other 90% of the words on the press release are about your selling out 16,000 seater rooms, it inevitably starts to seem slightly strange, you know. So that was, so I kind of thought, oh yeah, I misjudged that. But then this press release came in about 2 months ago, and I thought, no, it's like, that's just an ongoing weird thing for celebrities where sometimes...
But then a lot of that's not even in their control.
I know, it's not in their control, and that's why I...
But you and I, well, I make sure I write all my own press releases.
Yeah, and I mean, that's why you said to me, you're a control freak. I mean, I actually couldn't cope with the ceding of control that is required to be better known. I couldn't do it. And yet I'm aware that I hypocritically perceive that as a moral decision, but actually it's a psychological one. I actually could not cope with it. So the idea that it's in some way you've made some moral decision about not doing it is a lie, because actually you couldn't do it anyway, because you'd just go mad and you couldn't cope.
Not as good as Nick Frost with that rod of spunk going in his face, is it? Not as good.
But you asked me that question.
I know. But I think it's weird, because I think, like, with Ricky Gervais, I think he carried on that persona that he had early on, which were, yeah. Oh, I've won some BAFTAs, and this, you know. But he carried it on way too long, to the point that when it started, did kind of look like mock humble, but not humble. But then he was unaware. I mean, I think you'll never be in the position where you're unaware. I think you think about every single step and what's going on. And I mean, you sort of second guess the critics and sort of put that in before it's come out, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
You
use your negative publicity. What's the worst reviews of yourself that you've used in your own?
There's just so many terrible ones now. It's sort of beyond. It's not, you know, the worst ones are worse than you could ever have imagined. But even though you can put, I put things on posters saying, oh, actually, brilliant. The Sun one a couple of years ago was the worst comedian in Britain, as funny as bubonic plague, Fergus Shanahan. Who's now been arrested as part of the Levinson. I know, yeah.
David Baddiel's reviews he told us about last week were pretty bad. I think you'd have to say that, that Three Lions was worse than the concentration camps thing. Basically, it was something like that. It was something like that. But then, who is the real sick man in this so-called society?
No. Well done.
I'd throw it in because look, see one bloke, one bloke. And you do, in your website, you do a thing called Plagiarism Corner.
Yeah.
Which, so, do you think, though, I mean, because a lot of the things in
It's misunderstood, plagiarism. Plagiarism Corner is a bit where, if there's something the same as something I've done, I put it up there, right? But I also put up things that predate the thing that I've done. That's the same as them. And people seem to miss the point about this. I mean, partly there's two things I'm trying to do with Plagiarism Corner. One is to show that some ideas kind of exist out there and you can arrive at them independently of someone else, in as much as there's a bit of Tony Allen, the godfather of alternative comedy, in 1991 doing something that is exactly the same as something I've done in the last couple of years. I honestly say I never saw him do it. But the other reason I put things up on Plagiarism Corner is because I think there's a lot of people out there now using lots of writers, which wasn't when we started in the 1980s of alternative comedy. There was this kind of fantasy that the comedian was an auteur, and the idea was that we developed our own work and we were our own authentic voice. Now, a mainstream alternative comedian is required to produce so much stuff, they inevitably use writers, and the writers aren't always as... careful about their source material.
Yeah.
So when you see something in the mouth of someone on telly that is like something you've done, I kind of think, that might have come third hand from a writer and they don't know. So partly when I do that, it's to sort of send a shot across the bows as well of like, leave me alone, or I will do this. And there's someone deciding to do that at this point.
Because there's one from Buzzcocks, never mind the Buzzcocks, of them being put in storage, which is exactly like where we ended Fist of Fun with us being put in storage next to the glam metal detectives in our boxes, the first series. And that's just basically just completely copied to the extent even the guys who take them away are wearing exactly the same.
Yeah, I mean, well, the other thing that's weird is there's a whole kind of culture now, people think they're doing homages to things. But people forget that because they know about something, it doesn't mean that everyone
does. You can't
does,
do so. A homage to Fist of Fun.
You can't do a homage to something that has never been available on DVD, because the average person's not going to go to the source material. You know, and you see this happen to sort of art all the time. Like when Paris, Texas came out in the early 80s, of Wim Wenders' film, it sort of defined this amazing aesthetic of like slide guitar music crossed with widescreen American landscapes. And within 2 years, that was a cliche of advertising. So people were bored of it, but most of the people that were bored of it didn't know what the source material was. So I kind of think you have to watch out for the homages as well, you know. So I don't mean it entirely seriously.
No, no.
Like Dyer O'Brien had a real go at me about it, saying you should take it down. And I went, well, the thing is, there's things that... There's a thing on there where I've sort of done myself in, you know. And there's also... I had a bit up for a bit, I think it's gone now, where, like, Marquis Smith from The Fall was on stage saying I'd copied him. And, you know, I sort of had a bit, really. So I thought it was fair enough, you know.
But all art is, you know, is influenced by previous generations. Well, you know, I think both of us were very influenced by Ted Chippington.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, well, when we did the concert for Ted Chippington in 2007 or 2008... When we did our early material and stuff, you
obvious.
Kind of really see that how...
I mean,
he's an amazing comedian, Ted Chippington, Birmingham comedian from the 1980s, early 1980s. He started,
well, no, I still... I mean, I'm aware of that. Sometimes as I say things, I'm aware that there's a cadence of his voice in it.
Yeah.
You can't really escape the things that got you when you were 15. You kind of still... can't do it.
But that's what it... But that's... But, I mean, I think when reading your book... This is getting very serious.
Sorry,
anyone objecting... No, that's right, good. You know, all of these are different, that's what I like about it. But when you read your book, it is... I mean, I think I wrote a blog about calling you the Midas... the King Midas magpie, because it's like you admit where you've taken a joke from in your carefully annotated...
Yeah, yeah.
footnote heavy...
Well, not a joke, but like a flavour or
a
tone.
Yeah. So, no, it's not ever stealing a joke, but it's taking an idea. But then actually you take an idea that... Well, it's like, you know, with that, with the All Things Bright and Beautiful sketch you did, for example, that came about by us going to a wedding, and they sang All Things Bright and Beautiful, and it was a showbiz thing, it was like one of our agents, and I was standing next to Rob Newman, and we were just laughing at how ridiculous All Things Bright and Beautiful was, and we just got the real giggles, and you're going, what's funny about this?
Right.
And I said, this is what's funny about this, and then I would never have thought of doing anything about it again, and then... You took that one idea and turned into this kind of amazing...
Well, it's very kind of you to be generous about the fact that I essentially sort of was like a psychic vampire feeding off you.
But I would never have thought... I mean, I would have nowhere to put that at the time, but I would never have thought of doing it. It's the execution. It's what you said before.
Well,
it's also about...
Yeah, there's a weird thing now as well. There's nothing that slightly worries me about Twitter, actually, the internet. It's like your own experiences becoming... Like, you know, everyone involved knows that the... Alan Partridge, You're a Mentalist episode, where the guy's traps Alan Partridge in a cellar, is sort of slightly based on something that happened to me that I told Pete Bainham about, and he went off and wrote it. But that was like my life, and I feel like I should have had the right to exploit that for comic effect if I'd wanted to. But before I decided whether to do that or not, it became an episode in Alan Partridge.
Yeah, but Jerry Springer wanted to write an opera about himself as well. But there was a thing. Well, there's a part in it, bit in Alan Partridge, which is something I really wanted. I think I told against myself. But when I was in, I think we were in the Riverside actually, and someone came up to me and said, "Are you Rich Herring?" It was just when we'd just got on TV the first time. He said, "Are you Rich Herring?" And I went, "Yeah." He said, "You drop your credit card."
Yeah.
No,
I've heard that told like third hand. It's like, what a twat you are. Yeah, but actually, you know, yeah, no, but that's a lot of things. Basically, Alan Partridge is mainly based on things that happened to us,
and we created the character in the first place.
Yeah. So you know,
don't get any of the money from it, though, do we?
No, never mind.
I'll talk to Armando about it next week. I'll have to ask, is it true, Armando, that we created Alan Partridge? Let's see what he says.
We had a falling out about that. And we were some of the original writers on the air, which that character came out of, and we had a bust-up with our then-manager about whether we should get rights over the character of Alan Partridge when it went to telly. And in the end, it was decided that we wouldn't, but not by us. but probably fair enough, to be honest. But I always thought that it had never been resolved, and I always felt really bad that this cloud was hanging over my life where I'd had this argument with Armando that had never finished. Then a book came out about Chris Morris, Disgusting Bliss.
Yeah.
And I read it, and Armando was interviewed in it, and he said that on a flight to Glasgow when we were doing some radio thing with him, there had been really bad turbulence, and I discussed with him. I said, look, we might die on this flight, so let's just resolve the issue that I don't mind about what happened with Alan Partridge. I have no memory of that whatsoever. It was really great to read it in a book. I thought, oh, what a reasonable bloke I was. to resolve that. Well, I have no memory of it.
It
whatsoever.
Did happen. I remember.
Do you remember? Yeah, I don't remember it at all. I don't remember a lot about
it. You don't remember what happens in the morning when we used to write with each other in the premiere travelling across there's unbelievable. I would tell you a story in the morning or something that happened, and you would tell me in the afternoon. You would tell me something I just told you.
I can't remember much about the 90s at all. I don't know what's wrong with me. Yeah,
were you on in some heart drugs or something?
I don't know what it was. I wasn't on anything.
But it's quite good to have that, to not know.
Well, it's good to come here and find out what was going on.
And let's quickly talk about Club Z, which is, again, was this 1990s...
You were in that. Club Z was
You made me want... Again, let's see, I've got another memory. I was hardly ever allowed to be in Club Z, but sometimes Stu would let me be in it. And he said, one Christmas, he said, what I want you to do is come on dressed in your pants, wearing a gas mask and a Father Christmas outfit, and I'll have a whip. You had a whip.
Did I have a whip? Yeah. I don't remember that.
Well, I might have even been on a leash.
I think you were on a leash.
And you made me go into the audience and give out presents with which you had. They were wrapped up, but you got a hardcore porn mag and cut out erect penises and stuck them onto.
Yeah.
And I had to go into the audience and give these presents to people, and then I had to touch the audience, and every time I was inappropriate, you would shout and pull the chain or yank.
Yeah. It was the best Christmas Rich ever had.
It was good. It was actually... It was very liberating because I was disguised and I was able to go and just grope people. It was quite good. In the mid-90s, that was quite good for
me. That's funny. Club Z was a cabaret sort of night that was set up by Simon Munnery in the Market Tavern. Don't look for it. It's not there anymore. In Islington Green, and all sorts of people went through it and did lots of different acts, and the rules were that you weren't allowed, it had to be comedy, but you weren't allowed to do stand up and it was, you know, we did some Edinburgh shows of it, and there was a TV pilot. In the end, it all came to nothing, and then a few years ago a young journalist called Robert Ringham found out about it, and he decided to write a book about it despite never having seen it, and the book's out now. It's published by through Chris Evans's Go Faster Stripe imprint, and what's really interesting about it is it's compiled from entirely conflicting memories of people that were out of their minds during that period and can't really remember what was going on. There's actually a really interesting book of, like, have you seen one? Conflicting stories that don't add up, and it also makes you think how long ago that suddenly is. I mean, it's like being in the 80s and talking about the 60s. It's really strange how long ago it was, and also how we could afford then. No one had any money, but we could afford. We were time rich, so I could spend all week wrapping up children's toys in pages cut out of hardcore pornography to give them to Richard Herring to distribute to people at Christmas. Now that would not be a cost effective use of my time.
I've still got time to do that. I'll always make time for that. Whatever. But it was one of those things, again, that felt... I mean, there's so many things, there's so many opportunities that come and go, and so many... I mean, so I was reading, someone had posted on Facebook that letter about the first response to Fawlty Towers from a BBC executive going, this is... The show's as bad as the title, this is just rubbish and stock characters and no one will ever like it. Signed, Ian Milne or something, you know, and then that's funny because that show did get made and was really brilliant. Yeah. But think of all the shows that were really brilliant, and that letter meant the show didn't get made.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's millions and millions of things. I mean, Club Z's one of those ones that I really think the pilot of that was great, and all the leading up to it, and it would have been amazing. I mean, it's sort of, again, it led into Jerry Spring the Opera, and it led into the stuff that Simon was doing. But Simon Munnery never got that kind of credit for it.
Everyone that had worked with him benefited from being inspired by him. That's a really weird thing.
Reminds me of someone else.
Yeah, well, you know, Robert Ringham needs to write about a book about you, about people's conflicting memories. Perhaps it will solve this smashed cupboard issue. But what Rich said is absolutely right, and that's why I found it difficult when Kate Thornton interviewed me at the BAFTAs and said, aren't you excited about winning a BAFTA? I found it difficult to muster any enthusiasm for the idea, because over 25 years of doing this, I know that most of the people that are much, much better than me have given up or been ignored, or, you know, there's such a degree of randomness in it that I don't understand. I mean, I remember you were obsessed with a bloke for a bit I don't know who he was. He was a Welsh guy, and he'd won something on television. And when it happened, he shouted out, "Justice!" Yeah. Who was that?
I think it was the Sabutio World Cup. It was televised. It was me and Al Murray. It was Al Murray used to do. And it was I can't even remember the story. It's like they were playing, but then someone won the game of Sabutio that they'd been cruelly beaten in an earlier round. And he won, and he went, "Justice!"
Yeah, but in to the say face of this the guy. Word justice suggests that there's some kind of moral right behind what has happened, and that he's been not recognised for so long, and that funny. I mean, the idea that you could attach any value to winning something, you know, it seems it's just not in my mindset. So you just have to push on, but you know the alternative would be to get the BAFTA and go "Justice!" like that, which is clearly laughable when Limmy shows on, or you know there's loads of things that are great that no one ever notices, and there's loads of things that are great that never even get made, and there's loads of people doing comedy that are brilliant and are much better than anyone any of us will ever hear of, and we've seen loads of them over the years, so you kind of can't. I don't understand it. Even at award ceremonies, when people try and be ironically arrogant, it still doesn't work because it's just statistically and logistically impossible that the best people will be being awarded for the things that they are.
Yeah, well, the things that are, you know, the things that are best that you yourself like, that are your own favourite things, are often, especially for you, but a very niche thing that no one else even knows. Well, you know, you'll have a favourite sitcom or a favourite band or a favourite piece of music that isn't necessarily anyone else's favourite piece of music. And so that makes that, you know, so how do you, it's sort of ridiculous to try and compare one thing to another. But I also feel, talking to the people in this podcast, where I have had some very sort of high status guests who are doing very well, there's a lot of very intelligent people passing their time doing really stupid things for wasting their lives doing like with comedy. In 30 years time, anything you're doing apart from this podcast will have disappeared, and this podcast, out of context of everything we're talking about, will be really odd.
Well, I think the only thing that will survive of my career is the recording I was invited to make by the musicians Steve Beresford and Tanya Chen of John Cage's Indeterminacy, which is available for £10 on web.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good work. That was a Lee and Herring catchphrase I got in there as well.
Nice. Yeah.
Not as fondly remembered, because it got taken by the Fast Show, did it, and did better. Nice. Yeah. It's different, though, isn't it? Right. Nice. I was nice.
Actually, that's a funny thought. When we were in the mid-90s, when we were doing the pilot of Fist of Fun at BBC Two, the pilot of the Fast Show was also being shot, and with no word of a lie, the perception in the building was that it was this terrible thing full of unrelated characters. It was incredibly repetitive, and why had they spent this money, and it would never catch on. And obviously, you know, it did.
I had Charlie Hickson on the other week, and I told him about how delighted our producer was that it wasn't working, and how we thought we had won.
Yeah.
We didn't win. No. But at least Fist of Fun is available on DVD because we bought it ourselves and put it out.
We bought it back from the BBC for 2/3 of what we were paid to do it. So, you know, that's just like the debt's paid in full, isn't it?
There's only our debt. It cost them more to make it, unfortunately. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They only blew a couple of million on it. It's all right.
Nah, they didn't.
They get 25% of every one we sell.
Yeah.
So it's at least a couple of hundred quid for them. All right, well, you know, we might... It's been very late, but I can't even remember what time we started, but it's probably about time we finished. I'm not even going to do the competition this week, because, you know... Yeah.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
What are you going to do next? After talking cock, what are you going to do next?
I don't know. Why can't I say it?
Okay, all right then. When you started doing your solo shows, say 10 years ago, you were a young man.
I was.
I know.
Relatively.
Yeah. Now you're old.
I am.
Married. How has the stability that creates in life changed your approach to generating material and reporting?
I've only been married for 3 months.
I know, but
I think I've been with my delightful wife, Catherine. who's wonderful, doesn't like being picked on. She texted me in the interval to say, don't pick on me. And I'm not doing that. I'm saying you're wonderful. That's the last 4 years. You know, we've been together for 4 years. And I think in those 4 years, I've done my, you know, that's kind of given me a stability that I think the shows I was doing before then were kind of a bit wild and odd. So I think that's helped me to have... The thing is, I was really, when I started comedy, I just wanted to get off with girls, and I thought it was a good way to meet girls. And I thought I wanted to be famous so I could meet girls and get off with girls. But now I've got a wife, so I can't do that anymore, so I've just got to concentrate on working. So that's... So
God,
anyway, without...
I wonder why it will throw up.
So I'm working a lot
harder. You've
only
just begun in many ways.
I have, yeah.
And also, a lot of your best work was generated whilst you were living in Shepherd's Bush.
Yeah.
It's a very exciting metropolitan place, isn't it? Full of all different exciting experiences.
Yeah.
But the last few months you've been living in...
Yeah, Harpenden.
In Harpenden. Do you feel that you're now a Harpenden comedian? Do you feel...
I tell you, it is quite interesting. Because when I write my blog... in the last few years, there was a point about 7 or 8 years ago where I thought I can't think of anything to write and I would really struggle. And then I completely got over that. I just thought I'll just write about anything that happens and see if I can make it funny. Since I've lived in Harpenden, there's been about probably about 7 or 8 days where I've just gone, nothing is happening. There's actually nothing to write about. And so I'm coming back from Harpenden.
Okay,
so
do you feel that you have to stay in quite a difficult place to generate material?
I think it's good. You know, the great thing about London is just stuff happens all the time. When you write about minutia, which is really good, I've done that through the blog, and that's then bled into the stand-up I do, because I wasn't doing stand-up when I started writing the blog. So when you're really looking for little funny things to do, to write about, when you're in London, something will happen most
days. That's why I'm worried about, you know, getting older, having kids, and thinking, maybe I should go. Because actually, I think the struggle of living in London and all the different kinds of people bump up against, and the fact nothing works and everything takes ages, and all the systems you have to deal with are broken down, is actually creates this feeling of frustration and irritation in you that actually leads to comedy.
Yes, it's true.
And if I were to live in Harpenden and have a much more pleasant life...
Someone kicked in the glass in the front of the flats we live in the weekend.
Yeah.
Didn't write about it, though, I forgot. It was too exciting for Harpenden. I know, I think it's true, but I think being like people say with comedians, you've got to be unhappy to be, journalists say you're only funny when you're unhappy and not settled down. I think I'm funnier now. I'm
happy. Yeah, no, I think you are, but I don't think you were very good before.
No, I wasn't.
I did. Another thing I'd like to say publicly is I think next time you tour, if you're doing venues of the size you're doing and you're carrying around all your merchandise and your scope bucket that you take with you and doing all the driving, you need to get someone to...
I've got a man sorted.
You need to get someone to go with you, because I'm worried you're going to crash.
I might. I wrote a blog about nearly crashing my car.
I can't believe you've
not.
How much is it? It's so tight.
My mum got in touch, and one of my friend's mums got in touch, and you got in touch to tell me I had to have someone to do my...
You've got to take someone with you.
So you are like my mum.
At your age, you can't be driving around the country with a big bucket of coppers for scope. And that he's got, he doesn't let it out of his hand either. So he's driving one-handed with a plastic bucket of 1p coins for scope. Can you imagine the tragedy that how awful the people from scope would feel if they saw his severed head rolling across with all the coppers collected for scope and all this blood all over them?
I genuinely
They'd
think
wash them
I've
off
got
and
those
use
big
them,
boxes.
Obviously.
I've got those big boxes of program in the back of the car, and I do often think, it would be ironic if one of them were to crash and one of them was just to smash me in the back of the skull. And
it'd also be ironic if you were to if you were to be run over by a big lorry you would end up in a pool of your own blood in the wreckage of your own car with loads of 1p's for scope and torn up images of your own face. So I think you need to find someone who's happy to spend time with you, driving you and helping
being
you.
Alone.
Well, it's no good. Like you can't do it. I had to get someone about 3 years ago.
I actually think beyond, even with in terms of doing the show, you're too tired if you've driven
well,
for 5 hours.
It's not like doing a 20-minute gig. You're doing like 2 hours now. I expect
it's hard work. See, it's hard work doing this. This one's been quite... I don't feel tired at the end of this one because it's been quite laid back, isn't it? But the other ones, I felt really... Like last week, the end of the David Baddiel one, I was too... I was too tired to speak. It might have been he was just boring, but I couldn't be bothered to even finish a question. I started to ask him a question, I couldn't be bothered to finish answering. That's been very interesting. You've got three questions. Well, listen, because we're not doing a competition, because you've all won, because you're here. You got to see Lee and Herring back together again. It's not been as funny as you were hoping, has it? It hasn't been as much as you thought there'd be. Nat's chuff.
Well, you know, it is a long time. It's like it's 14 years since we wrote anything. And so, it's
nice.
But we will do it again. I mean, I'm actually, Richard's always saying, every day he rings me up and he goes, when are we getting it? But I actually think, when people ask that, the logical answer is, the problem is, it's predicated on a teenage relationship, which we obviously no longer have, right, which is to do with how we were when we were 18. The other reason is that I don't want to go around the country doing gigs and splitting the money at my age when I'm trying to get... But the other thing is, I also think that the idea of bickering 20-something men is funny. The idea of bickering middle-aged men is just like, yeah, you would. But I remember when we were on tour a long time ago, we found a video in a pound shop of a Glaswegian double act of the 1950s that typically, in the way of Scottish music hall acts, were huge in Glasgow, but 40 miles away in Edinburgh were despised because the whole culture's not even... I mean, Francie and Josie, and they got back together in their 80s and done this double act, which was clearly the act they used to do when they were young. And it was hilarious seeing old men doing it. And one of the few things that I want to live for, apart from seeing my children grow up, is to attempt to revive our routines, which, let's face it, were basically based around obscure pop culture references of the early 90s. I'd like to do that in about 30 years' time. Iced tea, the Cure, Kinder Eggs, the Crazy Croccos. Think that for two men in their 80s to try and tour that material in the mid-21st century would possibly take on a veneer of surreal art that we could never have foreseen as the young men that wrote it. So we do look forward to that. And I hope that Rich, through the use of all the modern technology that I'm so suspicious of, the internet, Twitter, the phone and printing, we'll be able to maintain this audience that he'll come.
They'll all be dead. They're already dying off our fans.
Thank you very much.
And so are we. Thank you. Give a big round of applause to Stuart Lee. Thank you very much for coming. See you next week. Kremlin and then Amanda, you next week. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with my very special guest, Stuart Lee. And it was produced by Ben Walker. He's all right, isn't he? The music was by Pest. Thanks to Orange Mark and everyone at the British Comedy Guide for getting this all together. Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre. They're good too. It wouldn't be the same without them. This has been a Sky Potato and Fuzz Productions production for the internet. How'd you like them Sky Potatoes? Thanks for listening to my podcast. It was fun, wasn't it? And it is free. If you feel like you would like to give something back in return for these hours of entertainment, or there's lots of things you can do. You can go to www.gofasterstripe.com to buy DVDs, including some of Stuart Lee's. And Fist of Fun is there. And Fist of Fun Series 2 will be up shortly with this on video if you want to see that. So that'll be in a couple of months, though. And What Is Love Anyway is coming out there as well. But go and have a look. There's lots of things to buy there. My show Talking Cock is in preview and will be at the Edinburgh Fringe at the Udderbelly. Richard Herring's Edinburgh Fringe podcast will also be at the Stand One. You can buy tickets to that or listen to that for free as well. My producer, Ben Walker, produces Do the Right Thing on the 26th of June. They are at the Phoenix near Oxford Circus, where the guests will be Katie Brand and Angelos Epifemimou. Radhal and Emu. I knew I wouldn't get that in one take, but we'll use it anyway. You know, that guy off Shooting Stars, that guy, he's not even really called that, he's called Dan. Anyway, thanks for listening. Tune in next week. It will be Graham Linehan and Armando Giannucci, OBE.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. RichardHerring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And GoFasterStripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. I do come and say hello after the show if enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.